I want to give thanks to the infinite cosmic creative consciousness that permitted me to be here today. I always start off thanking him. And I also want to thank Deborah Conway for inviting me to come here. She's been doing that for several years, and I've been promising that I would be here, and I'm here today. And I would also ask for you who have done all of this wonderful research. I think that you should give yourself a hand. It's been wonderful listening to all of the good things that you have done and the trials and tribulations that you have suffered in order to bring symbols of truth to the American people. Because after all, the reason that we are here is because we are seekers after the truth. Because we realize that the truth, and only the truth, is going to clarify what happened to our beloved president on November the 22nd, 1963. And there is a larger picture here, is whether or not we who are in a free democracy are prepared to accept a change in our government by fiat coup, assassination, and these type of extraneous type of activities other than the democratic process that our Constitution of the United States set forth for the change of our administration. So this has rather far-reaching effects, much further than just the assassination of a president. Because what happened on November the 22nd, 1963, was an infraction against all the people of America. It was an infraction against the Constitution of the United States of America. It was an infraction against the citizens of the United States of America. And so the people of the United States of America command justice. They want justice, they demand justice. And that's what we stand for who are in this room today. We want to bring to light what actually happened to our president on November 22nd, 1963. Now, I met President Kennedy, as I put in the echo from Dita Plaster. I became a Secret Service agent after having served in the Illinois State Police and after having become the first peak of the national detective, African-American, in 1956. A lot of people are overlooking that fact. I became the first African-American peak of the National Detective Agency on my way to becoming a Secret Service agent. From there, I went into the Illinois State Police, where I rode up and down the highway writing tickets, and from there I went into Illinois State Police investigating. From there, in October of 1960, I went into the United States Secret Service. Now, during that process of being an agent in the United States Secret Service, I was stationed in the Chicago office. It's 2-1. That's the number of Chicago office. Now, that number is very significant because later on in my life, those numbers, 2-1, played a rather different role. Now, the president was coming to Chicago to thank Mayor Daley for his help in winning the presidential election. And the president was at McCormick Place. He was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock that night. Now the Secret Service, by me being the first African-American agent stationed in Chicago, they had a little joke going, and they gave me a position that was normally held by a Chicago uniformed policeman that was standing in front of the washroom on the second level, on the basement level of McCormick Place in Chicago. That was a job that would normally be held by a uniformed policeman. After that, the room had been secured and it was set aside for the President of the United States. They didn't need an agent to do that. We were much more qualified than just to stand guard. So now what happened? They put me, assigned me, in front of the washroom. And when they did that, all the agents in the room laughed. You got the S-House detail. That's where you belong. That's what some of those in there who didn't like the fact that I was a Negro agent in the Chicago office. That's where you belong. So I accepted the assignment. I didn't expect to go into the Secret Service and within several months become the chief of the United States Secret Service. You got to start at the bottom. So I didn't complain. I just went there and I'm standing in front of the washroom at night, April 28, 1961. And I hear the motorcade when it comes up. And I hear the band strike up and I see cameras flashing. I'm watching up the steps. I say, I sure wish I could get up there and see what's going on. I'm down at the bottom of the steps standing in front of the washroom. And I see the press photographers there running back and forth and running back and forth. And I looked up at the top of the steps. And lo and behold, here comes President Kennedy. The first thing he wants to do is use the washroom, and there I stood. What iron is this? So he comes, he walks up to me, and he has this wonderful smile on his face. The president had a gifted smile. When he smiled, his eyes smiled. Every part about him smiled. And he walked and he stood directly in front of me. And really, I didn't know where to back up, step aside, or what to do. I was right in front of the door, so I sort of moved to the side, and he moved to the side, and he asked me. He said, are you a Secret Service agent, or are you one of Mary Daly's finest? I said, I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President. And one of the other agents said, his name is Agent Bowman. He said, Mr. Bowman, he says, tell me, has there ever been a Negro on the White House detail in Washington, D.C.? I said, not to my knowledge, Mr. President. He smiled, beautiful smile. I never will forget it. He says, would you like to be the first? I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. He said, I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And in June of that year, I became the first African American to be assigned to the White House detail in Washington, D.C. It's been over 40 years, but you can see it still affects me because I had an affection for President Kennedy. Because I saw in him a man who had deep within him the welfare of all the citizens of the United States of America. He had won the trust and hearts of people across all sections, blacks and whites and Jews, all types of people. He had won their confidence. And he had given especially the minorities in America a new hope, a new dream in the freedoms that he espoused. And more than that, we had the impression, and many of you may not understand what it meant to be black during those tumultuous days of the early 60s, where many of us were about to lose hope. We were forming all types of organizations just trying to find someone who that we could have hope in. And then came along President Kennedy. This sincere man who had suffered in his lifetime, even though he had multi-millions of dollars, he knew what it was to suffer. He had a back problem. He had problems within his own family. He had suffered. And I think that this gave him a certain empathy for the common man that he exuded whenever he talked to. You could feel it, you could see it, the vibration of this man was just something awesome to behold. So when I went to Washington, D.C. and became the first African American on White House detail, if the story would end there, everything would be fine, but it didn't. I ran into a hornet's nest of racism around the President of these United States of America. I was not called the N-word by any of the spectators while I was with the President of the United States. But I was called the N-word by many of the Secret Service agents who were surrounding the President of the United States. Now here's a president who is going on TV almost weekly. He's talking about the injustices of the people in the United States of America. And here is our agents who are surrounding him in his detail who are calling him a nigger lover. You see the dichotomy of the two. He is a man full of love and justice, and he's surrounded by some agents who would shoot him themselves if they had the chance. I saw this. And I saw a laxity, an overconfidence. I saw a cavalier attitude. And I heard agents who made statements like, if there was an assassination attempt made on a president, I wouldn't protect him. I wouldn't do anything. I'd let it happen. And this is why I'm serving as an agent myself. So I had a responsibility in that. I had sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, one of the greatest documents that have ever been written by any group of people who wanted to establish a government. And when I took that oath, I meant it. Now, as a result of what I had heard and what I had seen, the agents drinking, cabaret on the White House detail, it wouldn't take a genius to know that our president was in serious trouble if an attack were made on his life. So after a bout in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, where I had a supervisor to look me in my eye, and he was a supervisor on the detail of the United States Secret Service. I was serving under him. And we were in Hyannisport. I'm just giving you the whole scenario. Protecting the life of the president, we're supposed to be equals and brothers on a mission. And he looked me in my eye and he says, Bolden. I said, yeah, Harvey. He said, I want to tell you something. Don't you ever forget it. He looked me right in the eye. He said, you a nigger. You were born a nigger. You're going to die a nigger, and you'll never be anything but a nigger. So act like one. That's what the supervisor in the Secret Service told me. I probably would have been in Dallas, Texas. I probably would have been here had he not said that. But it shook the very foundation of my teaching and my beliefs that I knew that both of us couldn't remain on the detail because something would explode. Either I was going to shoot him with my .357 Magnum or eventually he was going to shoot me. And I was a better shot, really. I shot expert on with both hands on the customs range. I shot a perfect score. Both hands, first time that had been done. Everybody was shocked. So was I. Because I'd been up most of that night, and I think that that helped me relax a little bit. But I couldn't wait to get back to Washington, D.C. We got back to Washington, D.C. I asked off the detail. But in doing so, I went right into the chief's office, U.E. Barber. And told Chief Barber, I said, we got a real problem on that White House detail. And I told him all of the things that I'm telling you. He says, we'll look into it, Bolden. He says, you a new agent? And you know, a lot of time you guys come and you see things and you think it's serious, but we haven't lost the president in so many years, and we got it, rah, 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 but I will tell Jim Rowley about it. So I came back to Chicago. The president, his detail came to Chicago during an advance assignment in late 1963 and mid-1963. I saw the same things happening. They spent all their time down at the Playboy Club. The next morning they came in, they were doing the advance on the president. They were talking about the girl who was tabletop dancing and who was reaching up, feeling the girl's breasts. And we had a meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and two of them that came in from Washington, D.C., if you had held up a finger, they couldn't follow. We're talking about 9 o'clock in the morning. So when Inspector Kelly came to Chicago, I told Inspector Kelly what was going on the detail. And I made the prediction of both U.E. Bauman and Kelly. I said, if an attempt is made on the president's life, it will be successful. And I was really charged up about this. So I became known around the office as a crybaby. Yeah. Even left diapers in my drawers, hanging nooses over my desk, things like that, the big crybaby. But then November 22nd happened. Everything that I had said became true. President's brain laid on the back of his limousine. A tragedy for America and for the people of America. So what was the response of the Secret Service? We had been conducting many investigations, especially in Miami. There were investigations in Tampa. And there was a serious investigation in Chicago. All of these investigations were highly organized groups. These were not no lone guy who's sitting in a window on the sixth floor. These were highly structured, organized groups. We had one report in Chicago, a landlady went into a room. Now, I don't know how she discovered it. I was reading on the web the other night, and a guy was saying, well, these guys would be nuts to leave guns laying on the bed. Well, I don't know if they were under the sheet or the landlady went to make up the bed or how they happened to be discovered. That's not the point of the thing. But she knew that there were rifles in the room with telescopic sights, and she called the FBI and told them that she had rented the room, which was up around North Avenue in Fullerton in Chicago. She had rented the room to two Cubans, but there were two European men that were going in and out the room. And she also saw, laying on the bed, was the map that President Kennedy was supposed to come from O'Hare Airport into the Blackstone Hotel where he was going to live. And they had a check mark at Jackson and the expressway that the president was coming down, where it had to stop and make a slow turn and come down a one-way street at Jackson Boulevard heading towards Blackstone Hotel. The same scenario that happened here in Dallas. The same. Now, one researcher, after I discussed this with him, his name is Jim Douglas. Jim Douglas was able to locate and verify much of the information that I am telling you right now. As a matter of fact, he visited that building from which the shot was supposed to be fired, and it was the same as the Schubert Depository. And the person who worked in that building had been arrested by the Secret Service and the Chicago police, Thomas Arthur Vallee. He was arrested on about November the 2nd, on the night of November the 2nd, when the president was supposed to come to Chicago to Army Navy football game. Now, we had another investigation that was going on at that time. It had started in October of 1963, and this was the Escherrera case. Escherrera had strong connections, number one, with the CIA. We had an informant right next to Asher Air. And he had connections also with the FBI. He was a member of a Cuban organization that was actually gun running, and there was a lot of gun running activity going on in Chicago at that time. We knew about it. Because the informant came to us, now mind you, this was in October of 1963, and said, I was with Echeverria. And Echeverria said that the president is about to be taken care of. He says, we got enough money now, and we got to get rid of Kennedy, because Johnson is going to be a better person that we can negotiate with to go back into Cuba. That's what he said. And so what happened, the Secret Service muffed the investigation of Echeverria. And how did they do it? The agent next to me, his name was Joe Noonan, and he was the lead investigator on the Echeverria case. Joe Noonan and Edwin Z. Tucker. Their office were in there right next door to them. And I used to listen to them dictate their reports. Joe Noonan said that he thought that the CIA and the FBI were sabotaging this case against Echeverria. The FBI and the CIA were sabotaging a case of a man who said that the president was about to be assassinated. I heard him say that in the petition office right next door to mine. And so, naturally, I became kind of concerned about this. And later I heard him dictate a report, and this is all prior to November the 22nd. He dictated another report to Charlotte Clausen. And he was saying that the FBI, in fact, went to the informant who they had next to Echeverria and told him not to cooperate with the Secret Service anymore because they thought that this man was an informant for the Secret Service. They burned the informant who was next to a man who was said that President Kennedy was going to be killed. The FBI burned him. Now, we have a dead president. We have investigations. A lot of strange things start happening. On the Echeverria case, we were called in. Special agent in charge, Mr. Martinoff. The Echeverria case, forget it ever existed. Turn in all your notes. Turn in everything that you have on the Echeverria case. We don't want you to tell anybody that this case ever existed on the penalty of being fired. They rounded up everything, packed up everything regarding the Echeverria case, sent it by special carrier to Washington, D.C. Paul J. Paterny, who was the deputy chief of the Secret Service at that time, accepted it. I know this because I'm listening to them. They're talking about what they're going to do. And the Echeverria case disappeared. After the president was assassinated, the secretaries began to bundle up all of the reports that were filed pertaining to President Kennedy's visit to Chicago. They packed up the copy of those PRS reports and sent them to Washington, D.C. That's only one reason for that, is to corral all of the reports so that the information that would be given to the special agent who was investigating this would all come from one source. And the only thing that could be proven would have to come from the chief of the United States Secret Service, who had every report. And the field office didn't have any copies of any report relating to the President Kennedy in Chicago. So I felt that this was a terrific cover-up going on. It was a cover-up. And you know, I became positive of the cover-up. And this is why I admire you researchers so much. And I know that's the job that you have to do. But the fact of the matter is as it says in the Bible, a little leaven, leaven is the whole loaf. And what happened after the president was assassinated, this Echeverria case that was investigated in October and November, the early part of November, the special agent in charge redictated the report. I know this from my own firsthand knowledge because I heard the girl retype it. I went in the office and I looked, and the dates were changed from October the 27th when they received the information to November the 27th after the president was assassinated, 1 month later. They submitted a false report on the Echeverria case. They investigated that case from October of 1963 to November, about November 15, 1963, after the president was assassinated. They said that the investigation of Echeverria started on the 27th of November. Why that? Because they wanted to exclude Echeverria and the case and the Cuban organization from having any complicity in the assassination of the president. That's why it is so difficult for you researchers to get to the bottom of this, because reports have been changed, they have been doctored to obfuscate. These people are looking far to this day. That was a conscious effort. This was no accident. They were covering their tracks, and they were covering them in a big way so that you could never undo this Rubik's Cube that they were setting up. Dates are changed. What people did are changed. The special agent in charges are submitting summary reports and ignoring certain facts. As a matter of fact, in 1964, when they arrested me, and I went on TV, national television, and told them American people what this was all about, they called me a liar. They said a man's a liar. These things didn't happen. And of course they did. Now it's being proven. The more papers and documents that the warrant that they release out of Washington, D.C., the more that the people know that I'm telling the truth. Now, the Warren Commission was set up to investigate the assassination of the president. We all know that. But what I didn't know at the time was that it was the official government policy at that time to tell American people, rightfully or wrongfully, that Oswald was the lone assassin. That came down as an official policy from the government. Now, what police organization would go out and investigate a crime with the man already made up? They already had a suspect, they had the murder, and he did it. This is the conclusion that we must reach. It's ridiculous. And so that's what you researchers are up against. You're up against a structure that said, this is the way that we wanted things to go. And that's what you're up against, that little labor, that labor, the whole loaf. And so when I wanted to speak about this, I complained like heck. I complained at the meetings with tears in my eyes. You got the president killed. And they start watching me. My wife used to tell me a lot of time, I hear clicks on the telephone. I hear funny clicks. I picked it up and I heard a couple of guys talking one time. We don't have a party line. And they were watching. So the first opportunity I went to Washington, D.C., the Warren Commission was sitting, and I knew that J.D. Rankin was the chief counsel of the Warren Commission. I confided in one agent that I wanted to testify before that commission and let them know the cover-up that the Secret Service was engaging in. Well, I was sitting in class when I went to Washington, D.C. I went to call Jamie Rankin. I had to go through the White House switchboard because I had no idea just how to dial him straight in. I didn't know the hotel where he was staying, his home number, anything. But I did know this as being an agent that you could find anybody through the White House switchboard. They had all of the numbers there, all your congressmen and everybody who was an official in Washington, D.C., a Secret Service agent, could get it from the White House switchboard. But there was another agent who I believe to this day was following me. So when I went in one telephone phone booth, he went in the other. And when I dialed a number at that particular time, it was a WH number for White House, I didn't hear a dime fall in his telephone, and I knew that he was watching me. I never heard it. You know, back in the old days, some of you are too young to remember that, but we used to have telephones, you put a dime in, and you hear ding, ding. But I didn't hear that, and that let me know that this guy wasn't making a telephone call, and he was listening to me. Well, to make a long story short, the next day, I'm sitting up in the classroom. The personnel director, Howard Anderson, of the Secret Service, comes to me and says, we need you back in Chicago. We need you on a counterfeit investigation to go undercover in the city near outside of Chicago, Villa Park. I'm knowing, you know, Villa Park is about 99 9/10 white. And what could I go undercover out there, you know? That would be just like saying go undercover in the Klan or something like that. What could I find out there? You know, because usually sophisticated counterfeiters, you know, they don't have floor sweepers or anything like that working in their shop. So I'm suspicious of this. You know, I was a smart guy. Don't take no genius to figure that out. So they put me on the plane. We flew back to Chicago, and we went in to the state's attorney's, U.S. attorney's office. And they held me in there about 3 hours, like they were trying to figure something out, what to do with this guy. It was hot that day, too, about 96 degrees. So finally, the tension broke. It broke before I did. They forced me to take some kind of made-up polygraph test. Now, I had a person ask me, why do you think if they thought that you didn't do anything, did they make you take a polygraph test? Well, man, how ridiculous would it be not to give an agent, if you want to accuse him of something, a polygraph test? You got to at least make the things look presentable. But they never made any record of it. You know, polygraphs are not admissible in court anyway. You can beat a polygraph very easy. All you have to do is put a rock in your shoe or bite your tongue. Every time that they ask you a question that's the truth, you bite your tongue and you get a response, a wiggle on the polygraph machine because of pain, not because of you lying. But there's not too much difference in the characteristics. When you bite your tongue, that's when you're actually telling the lie. So all these criminals know that. They can put a rock, you can put a rock in your shoe, and when they ask you a question, it's true, you put your feet down on that rock and do pain. And so when you actually tell a lie, they both look the same. It's easy. Well, but anyway, the supervisor came in and said, we charging you with soliciting the bribe. I almost fell out the chair. I said, what? Mr. Martin, no. And they took me to trial. And they were two of the most unfair trials. You talk about the Constitution of the United States being trampled. I was treated much worse, and you read it in the book. That go from D to Plants. They don't even treat terriers like they treated me. You denied me an attorney. When I went to trial, the 12 members of the jury, they were deliberating, trying to decide whether or not I was guilty or innocent. The judge stops them deliberating, tells the marshal, bring the jury in. He commences to tell the jury, in my opinion, the defendant is guilty. Yeah, of counts 1, 2, and 3 in indictment. Now go back in and consider this, the verdict on what I've just told you. And I'm sitting there, an agent of the United States government. Of course, I knew what was going on. My lawyer was scared to death because I wanted to bring forth the tie-in with the Kennedy assassination. He was told me that I'd get him killed and myself killed too. Well, I didn't care about me, but he cared about him. I felt that they were at it. So I had a second trial, and here the jury deliberating again. I had a second trial within 30 days. Record time, man, they really wanted to get me down. And the jury is deliberating again, 12 more. So the judge, about 5:30 in the evening, he calls the jury out of the time. He called my attorney and me up to the bar along with the attorney general of the United States who was prosecuting the case and said, it's getting late. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to close the courtroom. And if the jury comes upon a verdict, then they'll seal it up and report it tomorrow. So I'm going to clear the courtroom. So he cleared the courtroom of me, my attorneys, all of the spectators, and anybody associated with the defense. The only people who were left in the courtroom were FBI agents, there were 2 CIA agents, the prosecutors, the marshals, the judge, and the jury. The whole building, he locked us out of the whole building. And of course they found me guilty, of course. They sent me away, but that's all right. I mean, if the story ended there, that'd be all right. But I knew it wasn't going to end there. The government wanted to discredit me and discredit me forever. I knew that they had it in for me. It's not how much I knew, but it was the quality of the information that I had. Because the information that I'm telling you today, it lets you know that there was a systematic effort to obfuscate, the truth about who assassinated President John F. Kennedy. And that in itself is a crime, and it's a crime by high officials in the United States government. So they sent me away. I did pretty good time. I learned how to jail, as the boys said. But I knew that they were going to try to spring a trap for me somewhere down the line. I just knew. So I kind of got out in front of them. So I got an attorney in Springfield, Missouri. I knew that they had a place there where they like to declare people insane. They had St. Elizabeth in Washington, D.C. They got a place there where they sent a lady, tried to declare her insane because she had some sensitive information. So I knew how they worked, so I hired attorneys there. Sure enough, they sent me to Terre Haute. Then they snuck me in the Fort Leavenworth. Then they put me in a secretary's route, the Springfield Medical Center for Federal Prisoners. He put me in a camp there. Now, at Springfield is noted for the levels of prisoners that they have there. They have hospital prisoners who have operations. They have the camp there. Then it's a transitory prison, and it's the most dreaded prison for psychiatrics. That's where they send you when you're beyond rehabilitation, when you're just absolutely psychotic. And so they eased me in the camp, you know, real close. You know, they didn't put me in there right away. They put you close, you know. Let you see these inmates walking around in the cafeteria, have to think to breathe. They're so doped up. And I knew that they had this in line for me to discredit me for the rest of my life, so that I would never stand where I'm standing today with the mind that I have today. So at 3 o'clock in the morning on July 6, 1967, two guards came to me in the middle of the night. I'd had an argument about 4 or 5 days before with a man who had been declared insane. It was a minor argument. Wasn't nothing to it. He drew a knife on me with about a 12-inch long shank. But I held it because I had a bucket of boiling water, and there was a standoff. His shank in my water. And I came out pretty good, but the officer who was in head of the kitchen, instead of looking at this inmate who had been declared insane, threatening me, he said it was my fault because that man was insane and he had a knife and I had no right to try to discipline this man. Well, I objected to that, you know, I objected to that. And so, make a long story short, they came and got me on that pretense. And before I went there to the psychiatrist, I talked to Dr. Kinsella, the psychiatrist. And when we were discussing my trial, he was saying that all of this are delusions. He said these were my delusions of persecution that a judge would not say that, without even looking at the record. Oh, those are persecution complex. Well, they came and got me. 3 o'clock in the morning. Woke me up. We marched in the basement of Springfield Medical Center for Federal Prisoners. And all you could hear was the jangling of these keys on the guard's belt. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I knew where they were taking me. They were taking me in what they would hope would be a death sentence for me. You see, with the government, if you're in their custody and they declare you insane, your time stops. You cannot do time with the government if they declare you insane until you are declared sane again. So I could be in Springfield now, declared insane, forever. So it was a very dangerous and precarious situation to be in. So they took me back there in what they call 2-1 East. The boys at Springfield called it, they got a name for it, they called it the tomb. Because they say you go in there, you don't come out the same. You'll never be the same. These people get you back there and they destroy your mind. They twist you up with those drugs. So they took me back there and they undressed me. They put me in one of the strip cells. About my wife and 3 children. I know I got to move it along, but this was really something. And my law and my government is trying to destroy me. But my wife had already told me when I was in a cell in Chicago on my way for the first day to the penitentiary. She looked me in the eye. She said, "Abe, you're going to have to be strong." She said, "You're going to have to be strong to go through this. So you don't have to worry about us. You just take care of yourself. I'll take care of the family. You just be strong." I just kept thinking about that. Be strong. So I found out a way, and you'll have to buy the book in order to see what happened. I found out a way. to meet these. And by the grace of God, I'm here today, and I'm strong. I feel good. I got a little arthritis, but I feel good. I feel intelligent. My mind is clear. I'm in front of some beautiful people, and everything is just wonderful. And I'm glad that you invited me to be here today, and I hope I've said something of inspiration to you. Thank you very much.